Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 7, Trading and Investment Practices Affecting Hedge Funds. David Sirignano, Ronnie Doyle, and Amy Kroll will discuss shareholder activism, developments in the bad actor rules, and other market developments. Now, on to the podcast.
Hi, my name is David Sirignano. I'm a corporate securities lawyer in our Washington office. I have two new faces to this conference with me today. On my right is Ronnie Doyle, also in our Washington office, also a corporate securities lawyer. On my left is Amy Kroll, who specializes in broker-dealer regulation, also in the Washington office. We're going to discuss matters ranging from issues arising in shareholder activism campaigns, some developments in the bad actor rules, and other types of market developments. Ronnie, I think you go first.
Okay, hi, thanks. I'm happy to be here, and I hope you all are enjoying the conference so far. I'm going to spend a few minutes on activism, even though most of you in the audience and many of our clients actually aren't activists. The reason for talking about them is some of the regulatory issues that they need to deal with are ones that you need to deal with in terms of disclosure and being aware of this Section 13 DG rules and so on and so forth. And also, just as a point of being practitioners, we've all read the newspapers over the last couple of years, and this is something that is increasing in activity. And I think some of the reasons we're seeing increased activity is because these activist investors are showing some good track records. And there's also some perception that there are continued opportunities to improve corporate performance, whether it's from a governance perspective or from a financial perspective. So some of these opportunities, some say, are fairly obvious, and that even without shareholder activism, you'd see these companies take steps to do spin-offs and to improve corporate governance as these trends become more and more clear. But nevertheless, the instigation of the activists to do this work is allowing them to develop reputations and to increase attraction of funds. So the environment is very good. And also, interestingly, I think some of the passive investors are becoming increasingly vocal about their own interests in good governance. So a lot of our public company clients have received letters from Vanguard talking about the fact, and actually one of the sentences in their letter specifically says, please don't mistake our passive investment position as passivity towards corporate governance. And Vanguard is, you know, which is, they say we're going to stay with you through good times and in bad, but they also say, we care about governance. And not only that, we care about meeting with your directors. And so they are wanting a dialogue around governance and around corporate performance in ways that are different than what we've experienced in the past, in particular with discussions with directors. But again, this increased dialogue in general is showing that investors are looking for more engagement. So that's the environment. We kind of know about it. I'm going to very quickly walk through some of the more recent notable situations. The most recent one that's of significance is the DuPont Trian Fund. That's significant because Trian even concedes that it supports the CEO. They even concede that the company does have a good shareholder return number compared to its peers and even the S&P 500. Nevertheless, it's pushing for governance changes in particular, and it also thinks that if the company does a spin-off, which the company has already initiated on its own, that there will be some financial improvements that the shareholders will realize. So while DuPont has taken significant steps towards doing things on its own, Trian keeps pushing in particular for post-spin governance changes. So that's very interesting. You wouldn't think that DuPont would be a company subject to an activist campaign, but nevertheless it was. eBay I'll cite only because the use of Twitter in that campaign, I think, was very high. I think they were kind of trying to outdo each other on who was going to use Twitter better. And so I think that's just another indication of how social media is increasingly making its way into corporate communications in a way that actually does have impact. So that's sort of out there. We also have the Allergan Pershing Square Valiant situation, which is notable for the shareholder referendum that they sought. And I'll turn that over to David in just a few minutes. And then lastly, I want to just note two kind of older cases that the SEC put out there, which continue to have relevance today. One is Perry Corp. And Perry Corp established a long position in shares with a corresponding swap position such that it retained voting rights in Mylan stock, but it had no economic risk. And it decided that it could be on a G because a 13G, which is the short form beneficial ownership reporting, far more complex and rigorous in amendment requirements than the 13D, because they were an institution and this was in the ordinary course of their business. The SEC said, how can this be ordinary course? The only reason that you put in this arrangement is so that you could retain the voting rights, which you were going to use to influence a merger situation. So they denied that that could ever be in the ordinary course and said that Perry should have filed a 13D once they crossed the 5% threshold. And In re Tresinda, people still talk about it. In fact, I know two good friends of mine who used to be policymakers in the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions, they'll disagree on whether Tresinda was correctly decided. But Tresinda's an old case. It involved Kirk Kerkorian. He took a position in GM stock, brought it up to 9.9%, tried to do some stuff with GM, and ultimately GM's board shot it down. So ultimately Kirk Kerkorian decided to exit his position at some point. He had some, his 13D said, we can buy, we can sell, you know, we can do any kinds of the transactions that are listed in item 4, which is kind of the normal disclosure. And at a certain point, Kirk Kerkorian had a discussion with his broker saying, look, I want to sell half of my 56 million shares. And the broker quoted back a price that Kirk didn't like. And so this was an ongoing discussion. Later on, Kirk countered with, well, how about if I sell 14 million shares? Ultimately, that sale concluded, and a 13D amendment was filed to reflect that sale. Then subsequently, Kirk Kerkorian sold down another 14 million shares, taking him below the 5% threshold. Well, the SEC said, you violated Rule 12b-20, which is the rule that requires disclosure of all material information. In two instances, it said, first of all, once you started having discussions with the broker, you had a plan to sell. Well, did he really? Because he wouldn't have sold unless the price was right. So then the SEC said, well, you ultimately did sell 14 million and then you had a plan to sell another 14 million. And when you filed your amendment and you said, you continued to include the generic disclosure, we may buy, we may sell, we may do any of these other transactions, that was untrue because really you were in a mind to liquidate out of your position. So that's a case that I still think reasonable minds can differ on when that item 4 amendment requirement is necessary. But Tresinda, it's old. It has relevance every day when we look at item 4 disclosures. So I'm going to also point quickly to an SEC speech. Mary Jo White gave a speech talking about activism. And in general, her comments can be summarized like this. Activists should not be disclosed as evil people. Some of them actually achieve decent results, and that the engagement between shareholders and companies in general, in her view, is a good thing. She also addressed shareholder referendums, the Pershing Square Valiant thing, and I'm gonna turn that over to David to discuss.
Just quickly, this is a new tactic that I think is worth watching. Instead of causing the company to call a special meeting or trying to get a proposal, let's say a sell the company proposal, to be voted on at the meeting or get it included on the management's proxy statement on the 14A8. Some activists are taking the tactic of just holding their own referendum independent of the company and management. Think of it as a town hall meeting or a poll or a petition, trying to get a sense of the investor base and then announcing those results. 65% of the shareholders responding said that we should sell the company and then announcing that result. The question is that subject to the proxy rules? Some activists are actually filing proxy materials with the SEC in connection with those type of campaigns. One reason may be they just don't want to hand the issue over to management to litigate against them, but also it may be to avoid the possibility of triggering a poison pill. Most poison pills exclude from the group concept votes or proxies or agreements that are arising out of a proxy solicitation. And so they want to wrap themselves in the proxy rules to take advantage of that. But many do not. Many will call a town meeting, see who shows up, have a discussion, take a vote, and announce the results, but never file anything with the SEC. The SEC staff has said, if you file with us, we'll look at it. We're not going to decide whether you had to or not, but if you file with us, we'll look at it, but you better do it right. We better comply with all the rules. And Mary Jo concurred in that in her speech. But they really aren't very clear in what they will do if someone doesn't file, when this amounts to a proxy solicitation. Traditionally, I've taken the view that any collective action by shareholders, qua shareholders, is subject to the proxy rules. And even though they're not asking the power to vote anybody else's shares here, but the proxy rules do cover the consent type solicitations as well, where you're just trying to get affirmative action, affirmative consent from a shareholder. And that seems to be pretty close to what's going on here. So it's something to watch.
Maybe the SEC will be forced to say something more about that.
Right.
Now, everybody in this room is familiar with Section 13 and its D&G provisions. The key terms, obviously, as you all know, are beneficial ownership, group status. Again, when does that collective collaboration to acquire, dispose, or hold shares give rise to an actual group that could, in fact, also trigger the need to make a separate filing as a group? Per se. The SEC, fortunately, has some pretty decent CD&Is. They've also previously announced, after Dodd-Frank became law, that their staff is engaged in a modernization project around 13G, and some of the issues there are related to whether the 10-day waiting period between the time that you start acquiring shares and you have to file your D is too long. And there are really good arguments on both sides. This is the famous Wachtell, Lucian, Bebchuk debate. We'll see what the SEC says about that. There's also supposedly going to be some guidance around the use of swaps and how that's disclosed. You know, again, once you're in a situation where you're investing, the key is item four. When do you have a group? When do you form control intent? These are often very, very tricky questions. There's a sliding scale or a spectrum, and you need to think about them very carefully because someone made a point earlier about the SEC's broken windows theory, and that's in existence. The SEC just filed a mini sweep on 13Ds, failing to disclose some steps around going private transactions. And of course, I think all of the people in this room also need to be concerned about the other filings that need to be made when you're accumulating positions and just the ones that you need to make as part of your ordinary business. Tricky area, lots of work all the time, and careful thinking is always needed.
Okay, let me just set the groundwork for some of the bad actor discussions. We want to explore what the recent developments are, what the issues that people are dealing with today. Bad actor disqualifications were added to the 506 Reg D private offering exemption back in September 2013. Basically, this is a little bit old news. It's very broad. It covers a lot of persons who could be involved in an offering. The ones we're going to focus on for our purposes of our discussions are the issuer, affiliated issuers, their officers and directors, any person who's paid to solicit in connection with that transaction. Essentially, broker-dealers acting as placement agents are also covered persons, as well as their officers, directors, general partners, and managing members. There are numerous disqualifying events. As a general rule, they involve court orders and administrative sanctions arising in connection with the securities laws, but they do apply to other types of regulatory provisions as well, some bank financial regulators as well as the CFTC. So that's something to watch out for. One rule of thumb is before you ever agree to anything with a regulator, any type of settlement or sanction, make sure someone has looked at the disqualification issues to see whether you need a waiver and what the true implications are of agreeing to that settlement. Sanctions that were imposed prior to September 2013 are not the basis for a disqualification under 506, but they are required to be disclosed pursuant to new Rule 506D. So in connection with an offering in which you have a sanctioned person involved, you have to provide disclosure in the offering materials to investors. The one we want to focus on is what happens post-2013 when you have a participant who's been sanctioned but now has gone out and obtained a waiver from the SEC to allow them to participate in the offering. The waiver order itself has provisions you have to focus on. Let me set up some issues. The SEC tried to define in a CDI under what circumstances related parties will be deemed to be affiliated issuers, so you have to worry about whether you have these type of disclosure issues in connection with an offering. In the CDI they posted on their website, they make clear that traditional concepts of affiliation apply to the definition of affiliated person. So you need to have the notion that you have two parties, one controls the other, is controlled by the other, or both are under control of some third party. In the hedge fund context, I guess the area this one comes up most commonly would be the master feeder situation. Certainly with affiliated funds, where it's one or more feeder funds feed into a single master fund, all sponsored by the same manager, those would probably be deemed to be affiliated purchasers because they are commonly controlled. And so you have to worry about these type of disclosure issues. In that case, one fund's sanctions could implement other funds. In the unaffiliated feeder fund situation, where a third party sponsors the feeder fund to feed into a master fund or an unaffiliated feeder fund, that's not so clear, because unless that third party controls, owns enough voting securities to control the fund that they're investing in, they're not going to be deemed a traditional affiliate. So that third party fund probably will not be deemed an affiliated purchaser. At least, let's hope not. But it does raise interesting questions that are difficult to deal with, including whether these offerings should be integrated, whether it's a co-issuer situation where the master fund is deemed to be issuing through any channel in which investors are being fed into one of its feeder funds or directly into the master fund. The one clue we have on the disclosure issues was interpretation under 506D, the disclosure for pre-September 2013 sanctions. And the question was asked, for example, a sanctioned broker-dealer, does that broker-dealer have to disclose its prior sanctions to all investors in an offering when there's multiple broker-dealers marketing the offering, or just to investors who purchased through that broker-dealer? The answer given in that 506E context is that it has to go to all investors.
Just to clarify, so this is with regard to disclosures that predate the effective date of the rule. In order for those disqualifying events that would have been disqualifying once the rule was in effect, not to trigger disqualifications at the time the rule became effective.
So the question is, how will the commission treat post September 2013 sanctions? Of course, if someone's sanctioned, they can't participate in the offering. But if they're sanctioned and receive the waiver, what might control is the language in the waiver order itself. And the question is, what do those orders say and how are they being interpreted? And Amy, what are you seeing?
Well, what's interesting is that there is very ambiguous language in the incoming letters requesting waivers. Every entity that's requested a waiver has had to represent that disclosure would be provided. But the question is, if the entity seeking the waiver is, for instance, a broker-dealer that's selling as a solicitor or is otherwise an entity that's selling but only to its own clients, then is the disclosure required to be provided even to entities that are completely unrelated, to solicitors, for instance, that are not subject to the disqualification and not receiving this particular waiver? It's been left ambiguous. Some folks have looked to this CDI to say that should be extrapolated to even post-effective disclosure. Our experience in discussing this with the staff, although it hasn't yet shown up in any letters, is that the staff understands that when an entity, a broker-dealer or a financial institution receives a waiver and makes the representation should be with regard to those folks who are purchasing through that financial institution. We're hoping that at some point this will become sort of language that appears in the waiver requests, which would give everyone the assurance. It hasn't happened yet, but I can say we're working on it. Shall we segue to some of the other, try to cover three topics that I think are important for those of you at private funds. The first is, under Reg M, Rule 105, this is the rule that basically says you cannot sell short and then purchase in a public offering, a firm commitment public offering, if you've sold short in the same securities within a restricted period, which is usually 5 days before the public offering. The SEC and now FINRA, if you have a broker-dealer in your family, became very, very attuned to comprehensive violations of this rule, and over the course of the last, I'd say, 5 years has brought extensive group of cases, including in September of 2014, cases against 19 private funds and their advisors with regard to purchases that violated. And these cases have involved disgorgement, penalties, and prejudgment interest, as well as agreements not to engage in violative activity going forward. The bottom line is, if you have a strategy that includes selling short, you need to make sure that you have in place policies and procedures that are not only in writing, but that are followed, and you have checks in your processes so that if a secondary shows up in those securities in which you're selling short, you're going to have a way of prohibiting your traders from receiving allocations. They can buy in the secondary market immediately after the offering begins to trade, but they can't receive an allocation in the secondary if it's a firm commitment offering. If they do, it's a per se violation, and there's no way around it unless you fit within one of three exceptions that the rule expressly provides for. We've articulated them very briefly. I won't go into them in detail. Just know that the separate accounts one really requires that the advice being given to each of the accounts really is separate and distinct. So it can't be one person who's making decisions for two funds. Those will be aggregated. Just be aware of that. There is a risk alert that OC put out, the SEC put out, for any entity that's engaged in short selling. We've cited it here. It's worth taking a look at because it articulates what OC and the SEC are going to look for in terms of policies, procedures, and processes. Going back very, very quickly to the bad actor disqualification and waiver process, it's important to know that depending on the nature of your organization, there are other disqualifications that certain kinds of SEC or even Justice Department or other actions can trigger. One is if you have a public company in your family, there's the WKSI disqualification. If your public company has relied on its status as a well-known seasoned issuer, that can be lost depending on certain kinds of actions, SEC or court actions. It can slow down the ability to raise money in the public market. As David said, it's very, very important if you're going to think about entering into a settlement with the SEC, the Justice Department, the states that involves any allegation of fraud, scienter or non-scienter fraud. If you have a public company in your family, you need to really get on top of these disqualifications early. The bad actor disqualification that David mentioned under Rule 506 that he described, critically important, not only if you have a solicitor, not only if you're an issuer, if you're an advisor to a private fund, you need to be aware that that status could be lost if there's a disqualification in place without waivers. There are several others that I'm not going to go into detail on, but just be aware that they are there. One of the things that we're calling sort of an inadvertent disqualification under Rule 506 is, let's say you have a trading violation you agree to with the SEC, but they impose a requirement that you have an independent consultant come in and look at your activities. That can trigger a disqualification under Rule 506. Again, as David said, really consult with your counsel as early as possible on any potential settlement. The last topic I was going to talk about is the proposal that came out just in the last couple of weeks that would require proprietary trading firms to become FINRA members absent an exception. Just be aware that it's there. If your fund has set up a trading operation, you've registered a broker-dealer, and you've been a member of an SRO other than FINRA, you're going to want to follow the developments in this area. Perhaps think about commenting, because this could impact your ability to continue outside of the FINRA oversight, which is obviously a much more rigorous exam and enforcement program than some of the other SROs. With that, I'm going to wrap up.
I think that's it. Thank you very much.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.